I thought we would begin by spending time with our children. So that's why we have you seated in the front. And this is really special. The boys outnumber the girls. So I'm going to be asking, there are some girls, you count, but I'm expecting some good participation from the boys. I'm going to be asking some questions. And then once we get you going with answering questions, I'm going to present a story from Krishna's pastimes. And then I'm going to ask you some questions on the story from Krishna's pastimes. When have you started school yet? School starts tomorrow? Or started already?
Started.
Already? Okay, so this is Krishna school. Mm-hmm. So that you hear, that the process is you hear and then you vibrate or speak. Shravanam kirtanam, shravanam kirtanam. And by the process of hearing and chanting, the forgetfulness of Krishna turns into remembrance of Krishna. So that's what we're headed for. We're headed for remembrance of Krishna by what we're going to be doing now, just asking questions and having you give answers. So, just so there's a little order instead of chaos, when I ask questions, don't just blurt out the answer, but raise your hand, and then I'll call on you. And I'll try to get there's some are more outspoken, or some are a little more quiet and shy, so I'll call on some of the quiet and shy ones amongst you. Sometimes. We just observed Krishna Janmashtami, and in Krishna Janmashtami, much of the focus goes on Krishna's pastimes in Mathura, because that's where he was born. He was born in the prison house of Kamsa, because Mathura was the capital of a large area, and part of the large area was Vrindavan. And the occupation in Vrindavan was the residents of Vrindavan take care of cows. So one of Krishna's names is Gopal, which means he's the protector of cows. And another name is Govinda. Govinda means he gives pleasure to the cows and to the senses. So Krishna and his friends, the cowherd boys, and the gopis and the gopas, they lived in Goloka, or Gokula, Vrindavan. So a lot of what we heard during Janmashtami time is Krishna in Vrindavan, and also Krishna in Mathura. So I thought, today we go to another place where Krishna spent a lot of time, where his leelas were performed, in Dwarka. Dwarka. So before we go to Dwarka, let's spend a little bit of time in Mathura and in Vrindavan again. And one of the persons I want to speak about is this person right here. He was the chariot driver that took Krishna and Balaram from Vrindavan to Mathura. So who was that person? Akura. This is Akura. As you see, he's a little older than Krishna. He is quite older than Krishna. And who is this over here with the beard and next to him? Yes, who?
That's Krishna's mom.
Yeah, Krishna's mom. And what's her name? She's right here. Krishna's mom's name is?
Yashoda.
Yasha means fortune or merit. And Da, she gives. fame and fortune to others, Yashoda. And his father?
Nanda Maharaj.
Very good. And who is this over here? Down. Yes.
Isn't that a gopi?
This down here. This is. He's got a crown on. It's a he. It's Balaram. Krishna and Balaram were being taken from Vrindavan on the chariot of Akura to go to Mathura. In the process of serving Krishna, devotional service to Krishna, there are 9 different forms or expressions of devotional service. This is an advanced question now. Akura achieved spiritual perfection in one of those 9 processes of devotional service. Which one? Dada Leela, she's reciting in her mind here. What is he known for?
Vandanam.
Right, Vandana? Where, there she is. Vandana means prayer. Can you describe to us the prayers or the circumstances of his prayers? Well, let's go back a little bit. Here's some situation of his prayers. When Akura was sent by Kamsa from Mathura to go to Vrindavan to bring Krishna to Mathura, the plan, he told Akura that the plan was to kill Krishna. I want you to bring Krishna to Mathura so I can kill him. But Akura is a devotee of Krishna. So why would he bring Krishna to Mathura with the understanding that Kamsa wanted to kill him?
Maybe he knew that Kamsa couldn't kill him.
Yeah, he knew Kamsa can't kill him. He told Kamsa. What did he tell Kamsa?
That the last baby is going to Nathura.
Yeah. But what he told Kamsa was, I'm your minister. I'll take care of this request you're making, but I'm duty-bound to let you know. You're bringing your own death. Because Krishna is all-powerful. And there's no way that you can kill Krishna. Krishna will kill you. But I'm fine. I'll go. I'm very eager to see Krishna. I'll go see Krishna. And I'll bring him here so he can kill you. He bluntly told him. So as he was riding from Mathura to Vrindavan, he became absorbed in thought of Krishna. So absorbed in thought of Krishna, he didn't even know where he was. He was just thinking, when I see Krishna, he will look at me in this way, and then I'll say these prayers to Krishna, and Krishna will bless me. And he was absorbed in just in anticipating of meeting Krishna. So absorbed in thought of Krishna. Practically the whole day passed before he reached where Krishna was. And when before he saw Krishna, he saw the marks of Krishna's feet in the soft sand of Vrindavan, along with the hooves of the cows. And he was in such ecstasy seeing the footprints of Krishna, he fell out of the chariot and rolled in the dust of Vrindavan, in the dust of the feet, the footprints of Krishna. It's a very famous pastime, so we have a lot of paintings. And then in the distance he saw Krishna. And although he's much elder to them, he came very respectfully before them, and they were seeing him as uncle. And so he offered his respects. Krishna and Balaram said, let's go to the palace of Nanda Maharaj. I'm sure he'll be very happy to see you. So that's where Akura made the proposal to Nanda Maharaj, please let me take Krishna and Balaram. And Mother Jasoda is in the background saying, no, no. And Nanda Maharaj said, yes. Very kind of you to take Krishna to a nice festival. He's never been to Mathura. You heard there's a bow festival. A special festival held in Mathura. And Akura promised, I promise, I'll bring him back just the day after tomorrow. When the festival is over, I'll bring him back. And so the next morning, the chariot was readied, and as Krishna was preparing to get on the chariot, the residents of Vrindavan were completely in madness of separation, anticipating separation from Krishna. Some of the gopis, they grabbed onto the reins of the horses. Some of the gopis placed themselves before the horses. Some of the gopis placed themselves before the wheels of the chariot. Better to give up our life than experience separation from Krishna. And normally they kept their affection for Krishna hidden. But now it wasn't hidden anymore. Everybody knew how much love they felt for Krishna. They petitioned Nanda and Jasoda, please don't let him go. And the cowherd boys, weeping and crying, begging Balaram, please don't go, please don't go. But Akura went. And this is where Akura offered his prayers. He went, Krishna and Balaram, we're going to visit this place, Akura Ghat, in this coming yatra, going to Vrindavan. It's about 1 mile away from Vrindavan and about 3 miles away from Mathura. And on the way between Vrindavan and Mathura, the river Jamuna flows. And Krishna said, before I go to Mathura, I'd like to take my sacred bath in the river Jamuna. So, please stop the chariot. Akura stopped the chariot. Krishna and Balaram took their bath, came back and sat in the chariot. Akura asked if he could take his bath. And Krishna said, sure. So he went to take his bath in the river, and there he saw Krishna and Balaram in the river. He was astonished. They were just in the chariot. So he went back to the chariot. There they were sitting in the chariot. What's going on? So then he went back to the river. Instead of seeing Krishna and Balaram, he saw Anantashesh and Lord Vishnu reclining on Anantashesh in the river Jamuna. And along with, down here, Lord Vishnu and Ananta, all the demigods, and the prayer, the personified Vedas, and the four Kumaras, and all great personalities were assembled. And there he offered beautiful prayers. That's where Akura offered his prayers, by which he became a perfected being. But there's always a but back here, when the gopis, they begged Akura, please don't take Krishna. But he had a mission. He took Krishna. So don't mess with the gopis. The gopis cursed Akura that as we're having to experience separation from Krishna, you will also have to experience separation from Krishna. And that leads us into the story that I want to narrate, the Shamantaka Jewel story, because Akura had some role in the Shamantaka Jewel story. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to sit over here because I have to manually operate. But I'm going to, at the end of the Shamantaka Jewel story, I'm going to ask the boys and the girls here some questions. And I'll even give you some of the questions now. So when you watch the story, you can be listening for the answer to the question. But I'll ask you some other questions too. Then I won't tell you what the questions are now. So here's one. Who was King Satrajit? You don't have to answer, but it's in the story. And who was it that Satrajit worshipped, and why? And another question is, what happened from his worship? He encountered some problem, even though he was worshiping very nicely. He had a problem. What was the problem? Like that. I'm going to ask you, who is Jambavan? And who is Jambavan's daughter? And like, you'll think some questions like that. Just like the storyline. And then I'm going to also ask you, what lessons did you learn from the story? Okay? So now you know some of the questions before we even have the quiz.
We're done.
I'm going to keep standing up so I can see everybody. No,
so, let's start with the lessons learned from this pastime that Krishna performed related to the Shamataka jewel. What lessons did you receive from the pastime? Because when Krishna does things, he's instructing through what he does. He instructs by his words, and he instructs by his example. So, what lessons? One. Yes. Don't accuse them falsely. Okay, that's good. Because it can have some bad consequences. He lost his life. What else? Yes? Can you speak a little louder? Is that the same thing? Don't blame people for something wrong when you don't know whether they did something wrong? Is that what you said? Yeah. Similar, right? Okay. What else? Yes?
Nothing good ever comes out of being miserly.
Nothing good ever comes out of being miserly. Yeah. Yeah. That's true. That's a lesson. Yes, what else?
Don't fight against good people.
Don't fight against good people. Okay. Anything else?
If you can use things in Krishna's service.
What's that?
If you can use things in Krishna's service, then use it. But if someone else is using stuff in Krishna's service, then you shouldn't use it.
That's true. Could you explain how that is a lesson from this story? Yeah. Okay. Why did Krishna ask for the jewel? One sense is he asked for it to be given to Ugrasena, because in Vedic times, when there was a qualified royal king, the greatest of all opulence should be with the treasury of the king. So it should be given to Ugrasena. But there's another reason why Krishna asked.
Maybe he was testing Satrajit.
Yeah, more than testing. He wanted to relieve Satrajit of pride. Because Krishna doesn't like to see pride in the hearts of anyone. Certainly not in the hearts of his devotees. Can you think of some example, a different example from Krishna's pastimes, where he wanted to remove the pride from the heart of one of his devotees.
When he did that battle with Jambavan.
Okay, but in a different story. That was different with Jambavan. Jambavan wasn't pride, Jambavan was something else.
Oh, and he lifted the Govardhan.
Yeah. But why was that pastime enacted? Now, before the lifting of the Govardhan hill, Krishna said to Nanda Maharaj,
oh,
don't worship Indra, because we're actually dependent upon, he gave an atheistic argument. He said, just do good work, and those who are reciprocating with good work, they'll supply your necessity. So we're not have to worship Indra, we just need to do good work. But we're dependent upon Govardhan Hill. And so let's worship Govardhan Hill. But the pastime was enacted because Krishna knew Indra was proud. I'm king of heaven. So one of the lessons, it's not like this is my way of explaining the lesson. And those devotees that are regular, you've heard this dozens of times. It's a math formula. Something plus something equals something. So, pious activities, or the fruits of pious activities, plus a heart that's impure, equals pride. Do it again. Pious activities and the fruits of pious activities, plus a heart that's impure, equals pride. Many people engage in pious activities, like Satrajit, because he wanted something. He worshipped the sun god intensely for hours every day. He wanted something. Krishna says this in Bhagavad Gita. Kamaistaistai rittagyana prapadyante anyat devata, which means persons who have a strong desire for something, then they worship one of the devatas to get that something. By doing the worship, it's pious. And with that piety, they get the fruits of piety. Now they have the fruits of piety. But if the heart hasn't yet become pure, it's not, there's a tendency, it's guaranteed there'll be pride in the heart. So Indra has a pride problem, and Satrajit had a pride problem. Watching through Dwarka, not even paying attention to Krishna. It's not nice. It's offensive. He's the personality of Godhead, walking right past, not paying attention. Then he installs the jewel. So obsessed with, you know, the wonderful thing he now has, he neglected to invite Krishna to give his blessings. And then Krishna wanted to remove the pride from his heart, so he asked for the jewel, not because he wanted the jewel. He wanted Satrajit to be free from the pride in his heart. So when Krishna calls upon us to become free from pride, and we go, no. There's other ways to remove pride from the heart. And that's, you know, the hard way. Sometimes. Not always, but sometimes. If we don't learn our lessons by hearing and by descending mercy, we can learn the hard way. So, here's another, like, lesson question. Why was it that Jambavan didn't recognize Krishna? Why was it that Jambavan didn't recognize Krishna? Why?
Because he was so angry.
Why was he angry?
Because Krishna came in.
But he was Krishna. Why didn't he recognize Krishna? Why did he become angry when he saw Krishna? He's a devotee of Ramachandra. And he understood at the end, Ramchandra, you are the same. You're my worshipable Lord. But he didn't even recognize him. Instead, he became angry. Why? Because he was caught by material attachment. He was caught by material attachment. Meaning, thinking, my family may be in danger. So, due to that attachment, he became blinded. He couldn't see the person he was seeing. You see, he couldn't see properly because of attachment. So, lesson, when we're materially attached, it's not a problem to have something unless you become attached to that something in a proprietary way, so much so you forget the personality of Godhead, even if he's standing in front of you. Having something is not the problem, it's how you see that something. If it's to be used in Krishna's service, that's one thing. If it's mine and attached, then one can become angry. Krishna says that in Bhagavad Gita. Anger arises from kama, kamesha krodesha. And where does kama come from? Rajoguna. Some udbhava, by contact with the mode of passion, one develops strong desire, and with strong desire, anger, attachment develops, and frustration of or challenging of those things that we're attached to. So, what to do? And the answer is become attached to Krishna. And then see those things as something that's for Krishna's service, not otherwise. Now here's another lesson. This is a compare and contrast kind of lesson. Satrajit was really attached to the jewel. And Jambavan wasn't at all attached to the jewel. Why? What was the difference between... Go ahead.
Jambavan had really no need for the jewel because he was a devotee of
Ramachandra. Yeah. Yeah.
Satyajit had a material
desire.
He had material desire. He wanted that jewel.
Yeah.
But Jambavan didn't really need that jewel.
So it's the same object. For one person, let my son play with it. For another person, I'll spread bad rumors about somebody. I'll put myself in great danger because he had no verification of that. He just like started blah blah blah. Psst, psst. So, be attached to the Supreme Lord helps one become detached. But even one can be detached from a jewel and have other kinds of attachments. So, even those things that we have a tendency to be attached to in a material way, we should try to learn to see those things in relation to Krishna. Family members as spirit souls who are part and parcel of Krishna, who Krishna has entrusted us with to serve together as a family. See in relation to Krishna. And then it's not proprietary attachment, it's service to Krishna attachment. Very different. Very, very different. In the end, we heard that Krishna gave the jewel back to Satrajit. Why did Krishna give the jewel back to Satrajit? Wait, right here.
So he can remember the memories of Krishna.
Okay, what else? Go ahead.
Krishna knew that Satrajit really wanted to give back the jewel. Right. He just pleased the Lord.
Yeah.
So Satrajit knew that
Right. Krishna doesn't want to take things from us. Krishna wants our love. If something is given lovingly, Krishna will accept. But if something is given begrudgingly, Krishna's not so interested. He's not interested in objects. He's interested in our submission, love. He knew Satrajit was attached. 170 pounds of gold every day. How much do you weigh? Huh?
90.
Okay, so two of you. Almost. That's a lot of gold. Every day. He was attached to that. And Krishna knew. You keep the jewel. I'll keep your daughter. So we know that Krishna had 16,108 wives. So two of those, the eight are principal, and the 16,100 came in a different, well, they came all at once. But these two, Jambavati and Satyabhama, very, very special personalities in Krishna's Leela. Such a nice arrangement Krishna made for marrying two of his wives. All in one Leela. Here's another lesson. Sometimes it may happen in your life that somebody will say something that's not true about you. Maybe it will never happen, but probably it will. Probably already has. Lesson. What do you do when that happens? What do you do when that? Krishna is showing us what you do when that happens. My way of saying is, you just stand by the truth. Don't defend yourself or say, you know, you're bad. Why would you tell it? Just stand by the truth. The truth will prevail. Truth will prevail just as much as the motive goodness, ultimately, because it's supported by Krishna. Motive goodness will prevail. So stay in the position of goodness and stay in the position of truth, and everything gets adjusted. It may take some time, but everything becomes, truth will prevail. That's what Krishna did. So now I'm going to end with just the last little bit. I told you at the very beginning, remember the picture of Akura driving the chariot? And he was cursed by the gopis. You will have to experience separation from Krishna as we are experiencing separation from Krishna. Not exactly a curse, in one sense it is, but it's, if you do to others, that may very well come back to you. Only the scene might be different, but it'll come back to you. Last night at the Chicago Temple, after the evening program, one man, a middle-aged man, came up in big distress. And he wasn't able to hear very well. But his distress was one of those classic questions. Why do bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people? What about you? You know that one. Because he's a good person. Just ask him. And some bad things happen to him. And then you see some bad people and, you know, good things are happening to them. I mean, it's a nice topic. I'm just, you know, in a little capsule form. Those, what I said to him, and I didn't get very far because he wanted to, like, he just couldn't hear. Those people that are now doing bad things, they're planting the seeds of something that's going to fructify later. I said, you've seen the garden outside the temple. Before we had a garden outside the temple, it was seeds. We put in some marigold seeds, and we put in some of these seeds and some of those seeds and watered them. And look at that. There came some marigolds and some daffodils and some of this ones and some, you know, different flowers from a seed. So these people are planting seeds that later are going to fructify. Not that we wish that they're going to have to suffer, but something bad is going to happen for those bad things they do. Now they seem to be enjoying the fruits of good deeds. So somewhere back there's some good deeds, and now they're enjoying the fruits of those good deeds. And they're sowing some bad deeds, and they're going to get that. He didn't like it, because what it meant was he did some bad deeds, that's why he suffered. I'm a good person. So, if you're going, worst of all is to offend the gopis. Don't ever offend the gopis. You've got a big problem. Asakura had a big problem. Because after Krishna gave back the Shambhataka jewel to Satrajit, right, that was the end of the story. The next chapter of the Bhagavatam describes Akura and his good friend, Kritavarma. It was like more complicated, but just to keep it simple, they didn't like what Satrajit had done. He lied. Just because he was attached to that jewel. So they wanted to steal the jewel back from him. And the person who was engaged, like the hitman, to steal the jewel, killed Satrajit in the course of stealing the jewel. He not only stole the jewel, it took his life. And when that took, it's a long story, when that took place, Krishna was not in Dwarka at that time. Satyabhama had stayed in Dwarka, but Krishna and Balaram had gone to Hastinapur. They were going for the purpose of the Pandava's funeral. It was the time of the House of Lakh, and everyone thought Kunti and the Pandavas had been burned in the House of Lakh. Krishna knew, Balaram knew, but they went anyway to take part in the funeral of the Pandavas and Kunti. And while they were gone, this thing happened. So when Satyabhama woke up and went to pay her respects to her father and found him dead, she's Kshatriya. She arranged several things. She arranged for her father to be preserved, the body of her father to be preserved in a big vat of oil. And then she went, or sent messenger to Krishna and Balaram, please come back and perform the funeral for my father and capture the person who did this and punish them appropriately. So Krishna came back, Balaram came back. The funeral of Satrajit was performed. Krishna understood who had done the murder. They went to chase him. Time had passed, so he had gone a long distance. But Krishna caught up to him and let him have it. He was finished, searched his clothing. The jewel wasn't there. So they were so far away. Balaram said, let me just stay for some time. There's one king that we haven't seen for some time, and I'd like to stay there. And that's where he stayed for some time and taught Duryodhana the art of fighting with a club. Krishna came back, and Akura had an uh-oh experience. Uh-oh. I'm in big trouble. So he left Dwarka with the jewel. And when Akura left Dwarka with the jewel, Krishna's internal potency arranged that the absence of Akura, there was drought in Dwarka. In Krishna's presence, it's the internal potency doing something. But Akura had this special reputation, like his father Shvapalka had this kind of mystic power. Wherever he would be, there would be no irregularities in weather, and health would be good, and everything would be nice. You know, the daiva aspect of life would be very nice. But it was disturbing in Dwarka. So people started, they did it again. Rumor against Krishna. saying, because Krishna chased Akura out of Dwaraka, now there's disturbance in Dwaraka. There's drought in Dwaraka. It was Krishna's fault. So what did Krishna do? Same thing that we should do. He stood by the truth. Same principle. He requested Akura to come. And he said, Akuraji, you have so much gold. It must be that you have the Shamantaka jewel. Can I see it, please? Now, Krishna knew that he was involved in the conspiracy, at least, for killing his father-in-law. But Krishna didn't even mention it. Let me see the jewel. I just want the citizens of Dwaraka to know the absence of the jewel was the reason for the irregularities. And now, Kuran, you just stay here in Dwaraka. You keep the jewel. You worship the jewel. Like he said to Satrajit, you keep the jewel, worship it nicely, and everything will be very regularly, everybody will benefit. You keep the jewel. So, we're not Krishna. And somebody may say something bad about us. That's not true. It happens. I mean, hopefully it's not too often, but it happens. And this is the end of the lesson, what one should do. Don't panic, don't defend yourself, don't go crazy. Oh, why are they saying this? And just stand by the truth. Let your actions be what's beyond criticism. Live that kind of life, a life that's truthful and in the quality of goodness, knowing there is duality here, and sometimes you don't deserve it, people are going to honor you. Sometimes you don't deserve it, people are going to criticize you. Krishna says it right in Bhagavad Gita. Sometimes it's sitoshna sukha dukkha. Sometimes it's hot and sometimes it's cold. Sometimes there's happiness, sometimes there's distress. Sometimes there's honor, sometimes there's dishonor. It's the nature of the place. It's going to happen. Fasten your seatbelt. It's just the nature of the place. So when there's dishonor, what do? Stand by the truth. Take shelter of the personality of Godhead and just abide by truth. That's what a good person and a devotee of the Lord should do. Good lesson. Good lesson. So what I wanted to do was, and just like say, this two-thirds done. This is like been largely focused on our younger people here. Now I want to spend a little time with the older people. So the younger people can stay and be patient, or if you get restless, you can go do what kids like to do. And well, we saw you when we came in, you know, the skateboards and the things. Do you have a Krishna book? Did you bring the books? Where? Where are the books? Can I have one of each?
Krishna book and
Bhagavad Gita. Okay. So this, what you saw at the very beginning, the credits page, this is a production that was put together by the BBT, taken directly from a division of the BBT, the Northern Europe division, so in Sweden, for all of Scandinavia and Northern Europe, they have a division that prints books, and they put this thing together, this little presentation, and the technology is simple, the voice is a very good friend of mine, Kripa Moya from the UK, very wonderful narrator's voice. But all the stories are stories that not only children like, but adults like, and as a family, you can sit together. I know some families that do this every day, every evening. They read a few pages of Krishna book. Or like little children, I know some families where the children won't go to sleep until their parents come and tell them a story, a Krishna story. And they hear, they have their favorite stories, not you know, little kids, little than you. They have their favorite stories, and they'll recite the whole story, but they want their parents to come and recite the story. They know it, you know, all the details. And the more details you have in the story, the more exciting it is for the children to hear all the details, and the details and the details, and it's all presented very nicely in this publication, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And it's for everybody. When I was a brahmachari for a number of years, traveling all across the country in a van with three other devotees, we had a fantastic time. And we would fill the van, like one of those cargo vans, right up to the ceiling, from the back of the driver and passenger seat, all the way back up to the ceiling, with boxes of Krishna books. And we'd go around and meet, you know, people and introduce them to Krishna. It was a blast. It was really fun. And when it got down a little bit, then we would sleep on top of the boxes. In other words, we'd sleep outside the van. And then when the van emptied out, they'd fly in an air container, and we'd fill up the van again and just keep going. It was really... So it's for everybody. For people that don't know Krishna, the way that what Prabhupada has done is what he called a summary study. That is, he followed verse by verse the message of each of these chapters. So the details are there. But within it is a presentation so that people that don't know Krishna, perhaps children, or perhaps some adults, or certainly Western people don't know Krishna, the explanation that's included makes it very clear that it's not just speaking about mythology or fairy tale or something imaginative. It's literally the description of the personality of Godhead and his activities when he appears in this world. And that's one of the gifts of the founder Acharya of ISKCON, along with this Krishna book. There's the entire Srimad Bhagavatam. His original plan was volumes this big, 60 of them, and translating them with commentary. And it's now consolidated a bit, it's completed, and translated into something like, 40 languages. One of the recent ones is Chinese. Here's some nice news. One of the places that I also visit is China. And you know something about the government of China. It's not so friendly to religion. And I'll just say it, because they have like these phrases that they say over and over again. One of them is, China is a government of law. China is a government, like, there's a hammer in their hand. China is a government of law. And then the next one is, in China, there are 5 recognized religions, and they'll recite them. And then, what this is not one of those 5. And China is a government of law. So that means this is illegal. That's 2 + 2 = 4. But the Chinese government, although they don't want to recognize the religion, in order, because of the globalization of the world, and many people from China go all over the world and come back to China, and China's depending for their economy upon people outside of China to buy the stuff they produce in China, they have to show some kind of something besides recognizing religions. So over a period of 6 years, they had their scholars study the Bhaktivedanta purports of the entire Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. The Chinese government is now printing the Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita in Chinese. they've signed a contract with the BBT, and they're printing it. And then they're allowing our members that are not practicing religion, of course, they're just buying books, to buy the books and then distribute the books. And they know that we're doing that. They just don't want to recognize it. So they're doing it that way. It's recognized by the Chinese government. And that's cool. It's a major, major, major accomplishment. So they know what the message is because they've read it. They've had their scholars study it and make sure it's authentic and it's not any threat to the government. And it's authentic and it's not a threat to the government, so they're printing it. They took a license from the BBT to print it, the government, and then distribute it. And we buy and we distribute it. We're good distribution agents for the government of the Bhaktivedanta purports. And this is part of like a bigger picture of the founder Acharya of ISKCON, or my spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, who received a request. Just a little story. Around the 1920s, so this is like after World War I, around that time Prabhupada was in college, married, and had one child. And he was a follower of Gandhi, because that was trendy at the time. He was a believer in Gandhian movement. More than a believer, he was a leader in that movement. And while he was in college, a friend of his invited him to come meet a sadhu in Calcutta, was where he was going to college. And Prabhupada said, I've seen so many sadhus. My father was a religious man, and practically every day he would invite some sadhu to the home. I've seen so many sadhus. No, and his friend said, no, he's different. Please come. No. Please come. So to oblige his friend, he went. Here's the scene. It's up on a rooftop in Calcutta on a hot summer day in the evening, so it's a little breeze blowing. And when Prabhupada met him, first meeting him, just offering his respects and paying obeisances to him. In English, Bhaktisiddhanta said, you're an educated man. You speak English. You should take the teachings of Lord Chaitanya and deliver it to the English-speaking parts of the world. That's their, before they even exchange any words. And then later, after hearing the rest of the discussion, Prabhupada gave a Gandhi an argument and said, later, because while India is under British rule, if we go to the English-speaking parts of the world, who's going to pay attention? Your people that are under British rule, who cares about you? And his spiritual master answered his question, replied for 20 minutes in explaining one of the topics that I was asked to speak about this evening. So I'll explain it now. This is eternal, Bhaktisiddhanta said. It's not relevant by circumstance. It's relevant to the soul. Whatever the circumstance, it's eternal truth. And when the eternal truth is spoken, it's relevant. And it can change circumstances. And it's not limited by circumstances or created by circumstances. It's the well-being of the soul. It's the eternal interest of the soul. The soul has an eternal relation with the Supreme Soul. And that's relevant anytime, any place, at all times, in all circumstances. He was like very enthusiastic. You should take this message. And Prabhupada told us, when I left to go back to my home that evening, I was thinking, he's very qualified. This transcendental wisdom is in good hands. And he said from that moment, although he didn't formally accept, he accepted Bhaktisiddhanta as his guide and teacher and spiritual master. And some years later, he accepted initiation from him. And then Prabhupada was a householder. He had four children.
he has had a business and he was, you know, busy. And there were other followers of Bhaktisiddhanta that were sannyasis, and they were able to do so much service for him. So he then wrote a letter saying, I'm a householder, I'm involved in material affairs, but I'd like to do some service for you. Can you please give me some service? He gave him the same assignment. Go to the Western countries, English-speaking parts of the world, and deliver this message of pure devotion to Krishna. So it went into his heart. And as time passed, his children grew up. He entrusted the business to his elder children. They, with the business, were able to maintain the household affairs, and he went to spend some time in Vrindavan. After living some time in Vrindavan, he began to write literatures, magazines, and then the printer said, why magazines? Books. Magazines people can discard, books people will keep. So he began his translation of Srimad Bhagavatam. He had a plan, he had it all planned out, 60 volumes, each 350 pages with color photographs or color plates, giving, as he called it, the message of India, of peace and harmony in the world. You know, very simple way of describing what Bhagavatam is. Then this order to go to the West became reconfirmed when he was in Vrindavan making his commentary on Bhagavad Gita that he could then print when he got to America. So this is significant, at least, you know, devotionally significant. There's one verse, 241 Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna speaks about very single-minded attention for those who are on this path of perfection. In the commentary, one of Acharyas said that how that is achieved by accepting the instruction of the spiritual master as one's life and soul. So Prabhupada said, I close the book and said, I must go. He was thinking, how can I do it? I'm just one little guy to go do this mission. Very difficult. He was thinking, I'm unqualified, the mission is too big. But he read the commentary. You must, life and soul. You must. So he said, then I understood, I must go. So he began preparing himself in various ways with the books. And he got a passage on a steamship because one of the persons he had met who was helping him to print the books was Sumati Mararji, who was a owner, Mataji, lady, was the owner of a steamship line, Sindhya steamship line. And she had boats that were going to America for cargo. So he asked, can I have passage on one of those boats, the cargo boats? She said, no, you're too old, you'll die. You have no idea what it's like riding in a boat across the ocean. It's big waves, and even if it's a big boat, you won't live. No, I won't give you passage. But he went back again and back again, and he was so determined. She finally relented and gave him a little cabin in the cargo boat. So some number of days, two heart attacks crossing the ocean. In his journal, his diary, he wrote, if another one happens, I'm finished. But he had a dream, he describes in his diary, where Krishna came in his dream and told him, I will protect you, please continue. Carry this message forward. So he came to America. This was at a time, it was after World War II. Just after World War II, for a number of years, there was a ban, at least in America, on giving tourist visas from anywhere. It was like, you know, paranoia. People may try to infiltrate and give us problem. That very year, 1965, 1966, so like 20 years after, something like that, after World War II, a little less,
America started allowing tourist visas. Prabhupada had a friend, Mr. Agarwal, who was from his previous business days, and he said, "Can you have a son that lives in America? Can you arrange with your son to give me an invitation for a tourist visa?" And he said, "Yes." But, you know, years passed and nothing happened, but Mr. Agarwal in Butler, Pennsylvania, sent Prabhupada a letter, an invitation for a tourist visa. So Prabhupada immediately took it to the American embassy, got a tourist visa, got on the boat, had two heart attacks, got at the end of the place where you walk down off the boat with nothing. Didn't have a cell phone. Didn't have any money. He had 14 rupees, which you can't use in America anyways. There was nobody waiting for him. He said, "When I got at the end of the walkway, I didn't know whether to turn left or turn right." He had no place to stay in a big, mean New York City with a mission to deliver the teachings of pure devotion to people that hadn't a clue. What a challenge. So he went to Port Authority, got on a bus, and went to Butler, Pennsylvania. I don't know how he got the money to get on the bus, but he somehow got on the bus to Butler, Pennsylvania. And he lived for a month in the home of the Agarwals and their little boy, Bridge, understanding this isn't why he came to America. He was paying his respects to the family and then took a bus ride back to New York and literally for a year struggled because he didn't have any money. Didn't have any place to stay. Didn't have any sponsors or, like, you know, nothing. Just a mission. There was one Dr. Mishra, who was a yoga teacher, and he lived on the Upper West Side on 72nd Street, Manhattan. So Dr. Mishra had an office. No water, no toilet, no shower. Here's a sadhu staying in a place where you can't even take a bath. Can't even brush your teeth. So he would have to go walking on the street in the winter to Dr. Mishra's apartment, take a bath, and then come back and do his cooking on a little hot plate. In other words, extremely austere. Extremely, wickedly austere. But for one thing, compassion and the instruction of his spiritual master. And in course of time, some little interest. 1 year passed, and there was little interest in the south, in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, which was then, you know, not a up and coming neighborhood. It was kind of seedy neighborhood, but that's where Krishna opened some doors, and he began on 26 Second Avenue. We still have that storefront. I have a lease on the storefront for gatherings, and Prabhupada began there. Little gatherings of kirtan, just as we are doing. Lots of prasadam for the young Americans that were coming, and some teachings from Bhagavad Gita. And gradually it caught hold. And then those persons went to different places, San Francisco, Montreal, and here and there, and started centers from nothing, literally nothing, to a worldwide society where during Prabhupada's lifetime there were over 100, approximately 108 centers with deities all around the world in a period of 11 years. And Prabhupada translated something like 80 volumes of books at, you know, from 70 years of age till 81, 82, with all that travel and taking care of people, training them from when they knew nothing. It's such a powerful personality, in short. Very incredibly dynamic, gifted, and purposefully, I'll end with this, purposely he left behind these literatures. Purposely, explicitly, so that after he was gone, in the language of Srimad Bhagavatam, a boat would be left behind to cross the ocean of material existence. There's a verse in the prayers by the demigods when Krishna is still in the womb. Just observe Krishna Janmashtami. So one of their prayers is that a great personality, while they're here in this world, they create and leave behind them a means for others to follow them, a boat to cross over the ocean of material existence. It's exactly what Prabhupada did, and in these literatures, this is the boat. Not you sit in and put a sail on it and ride across the Atlantic Ocean or Lake Michigan or something, but the ocean of material existence by hearing regularly. So I'm encouraging families, just like this little time spent together. It doesn't have to take so much time, but little time every day, reading from Krishna book with your family, hearing the message of transcendence about Krishna and Krishna's teachings and the lessons to be learned. So, and they're very practical in life. At the same time, they're transcendental, like this. Whoops. Just by hearing this last slide, anyone who hears the narration of the Supreme Lord's pastimes, such as the story of the Shamataka jewel, or describes these pastimes, or even simply remembers them, is free from all reactions of impious activities and attains the highest state of perfect peace. That's a paraphrase of one of the concluding verses of one of the chapters of the 10th canto, Bhagavatam. Just hearing creates auspiciousness within the family. Transcendental kind. Not the worldly kind, the transcendental kind. And behind the transcendental kind, the worldly kind follows. And it's so palatable. So nice. Even little children can sit and be very enlivened, very, very simple, very natural, very, very powerful. So, do you have some copies of this?
I have Bhagavad Gita. I do not have Krishna book copies right now. I can order them.
Okay. We had another program and they all sold out. And I didn't speak so strongly about Krishna, but just people were attracted. In any case, if you're interested, he'll make an arrangement. Let him know. Yeah. And join together with your families and hearing these nice messages. And same discussing Bhagavad Gita. There was one little boy, Kapil, I think his name was, on Friday night. And his parents got two books. And I said, which one is yours? He said, this one. He said, Bhagavad Gita. What about Krishna book? He said, this one. Because he just finished Gita camp. They for 2 weeks, discussed chapter 10, Bhagavad Gita. With a PowerPoint and a whole, so many things. So he wanted Bhagavad Gita. And I think he'll like Krishna book. But now they have both. I invite you. Take advantage, bring these literatures to your home, and then regularly hear and discuss them. And your children can also take part in the camp. Here's one of the organizers, Jagatananda. So if you're interested in finding out more about it, perhaps next summer, you plan it in advance. Participate, bring your children. If the adults can also participate, there are all kinds of things to do, creative things, craft things, story things, cooking things, and so many things. And just being with the children as they're learning about Krishna. And learning the message of Bhagavad Gita in a way that children can understand. Thank you. Hare Krishna.
Yes? So, now I get to understand, like, you being part of America, why did you get attached to Bhagavad Gita and how did you get attached to Bhagavad Gita?
There's a long version, there's a short version. I'll give you something that's on the shorter side rather than the long version. I was enrolled as a student at State University of New York, and I was finishing my undergraduate studies and applying for medical school. And during that period of time, the war in Vietnam was going on. So while I was completing my undergraduate studies and making applications for med school, my parents at home were getting notices from the United States government saying I was drafted 1A, conscription. I was being ordered by the government to join the army, get a uniform, get in an airplane, and go off to Vietnam and take part in that stupid war. And I didn't have any interest in doing that. And I couldn't understand why they would take somebody out of medical school and send them to Vietnam and do that stupid war. So I just didn't pay attention to it. I just kept going. And they kept sending notices. My parents were getting, concerned. You got to do something. I said, okay, I got to do something. But it was, it's stupid, but I got to do something. And then I was advised by some friends that there are some people, Quakers, there's a Christian group called the Quakers, they have a setup to help people understand how to make a conscientious objector form. It's a form from the government, and you fill it out and send it in, and you can be exempt from the draft. So the first question that was asked is, state the nature of your belief in God such that you cannot take part in the armed forces of the United States of America. Being a, Dean's List student, I knew how to get A's in exams and fill out that form and get an A in exam. But I didn't know how to answer the question to my own satisfaction. What's the nature of my conviction in God? And that bothered me a lot. Like, wait a minute. What am I doing? I don't know what my own convictions are. So I started, asking myself, what are my convictions? And I turned to the religion that I grew up with. And, maybe I'll do it, another pass at it. Maybe I'll get some answers. And I didn't get any answers. I got the same, blank stares from the other side, so to speak. So then I started looking around. What's out there in the world of, in the spiritual marketplace? And I found there's a whole lot of stuff out there in the spiritual marketplace that I hadn't even known was there because I wasn't looking. I'm looking. And then, fast forward over about 8 months, and of all the different sites, I immediately rejected a number of things because, they were not even worth considering. And then some other things I started considering. And I made this plan for myself. In the course of each day, I would do 2 hours of this, and then an hour and a half of that. And learn macrobiotic diet, and offer my food to Krishna. And, stitched a whole bunch of different things together to see, what resonated. Not like what somebody outside tell me what it is, but what does inside tell me what it is? What's my conviction? What's truth with a capital T? Not because somebody tells me, but it resonates. So I went on that kind of a quest. And so over that period of time, of all the things that I came across, Bhagavad Gita answered more questions than any other thing that I read. And I was reading lots of things without the long list. It's a long list. And then there's more. And of all the disciplines, I was doing, 2 hours of Zazen every morning at 2 o'clock in the morning. It was an intense schedule. And it was powerful practice, but it didn't have the spiritualizing effect of chanting Hare Krishna. And I was chanting other things too, like 4 other things. But chanting Hare Krishna had greater spiritualizing effect in my life than anything else. So I just kind of narrowed my options down and was with this. And I wasn't like, okay, that's it. It was, let me see where this goes. You know, how does it resonate? You know, I was a little stubborn. I honestly, I felt cheated. I was, you know, it goes along with the age I was in, kind of like counter-revolutionary. I was like mad, angry, that here I am going down the conveyor belt of success without even knowing who I am, what my convictions are. I'm not supposed to ask that. That's not important. I felt cheated. So I did a timeout, and I want to find out what my convictions are. However long it takes, I don't want to be the end of that conveyor belt and I'm still like big question mark over my head. I don't want to do that. I refused. I was like belligerent. And I'm not going to take somebody. So that was my mood, and that was the methodology. And there's many other things, but this resonated the most and spiritualized the most. And then I met Prabhupada. And that, you know, meeting a perfect person isn't usual. It's quite unusual. And that was compelling. So I understood, skipping many details, that he wanted to give something. And I felt obliged to receive that which he wanted to give, in the way he wanted to give it, not in the way that I wanted to like hang out with it, but to receive the way that he wanted to give it and give it to others. So I decided to spend some time in an ashram, because one of the places that I had visited to attend as a potential graduate school place was in Boston. Lots of colleges in Boston, so I went to Boston to explore. And when there I visited the temple, I liked the temple. So I went back and stayed in the Boston temple as an experiment to see where it goes. And so that's how, a little more colorful, the details, but that's like the basic picture. I didn't, you know, the quest wasn't, I want to go live become a monk or live in an ashram, or that's not how it started. But it was sincere asking the question, you know, the fundamental ones that we're usually too busy to ask. Like, who am I? And is there a higher purpose to life than being on the conveyor belt? Not like you can't be on the conveyor belt, but you got to have a purpose while you're on the conveyor belt. If you don't know what the purpose is, you don't even ask the question, that's not good. So that's how it started. And then one thing led to the next thing, that, you know, ruling things out, and Prabhupada came to visit our campus. And I met him. Well, I didn't meet him. I was in that assembly. And that had a very powerful impact, just being in that assembly, being in his presence. At that time I didn't know who he was. It was very fortunate. Along with a lot of other people that were also fortunate. Then what you do with fortune depends on, you know, individual choices that we make after we receive some fortune. So that's a little autobiographical stuff. Any other questions? Or comments? Okay. So, what would you like?
Last question.
Okay. My consciousness was different, or actually my consciousness was more covered when I first started associating with devotees and hearing from Prabhupada. You know, in retrospect, I can say what I just said. I found a perfect person. Because I was asking the same questions of so many other people. But it just didn't resonate. Not only the message wasn't the same, but the purity wasn't the same. So how my association with Prabhupada affected me is it lifted me out of being covered to, you know, some recognition of some of the things that Prabhupada wrote. I didn't like. And then I started asking myself, what is it about what he's written that I don't like? In other words, some attachment inside. And so through association with through association with a pure person, I was able to see where my own attachments are. Because I didn't so much doubt him, but I felt something about some of the things that he said. So it told me there's something inside I'm attached to. What is that? Like one of them, I just give an example. One of them was when I started reading about Krishna urging Arjuna to fight. This was during the Vietnamese War. When, you know, peace, you know, peace and love and flowers and that war. And Krishna's urging Arjuna to war. So I closed the book and said, I'm out of here. Whoever he is, you know, I don't want anything to do with this. And I was angry. I thought, wait a minute, where I'm just reading a book. Where's this anger coming from? What's all this about? So I didn't just like stay with the close the book, I'm out of here. There's something inside. I'm attached to something. And the realization was, I have an issue with Krishna. So let me hear, now with that in mind, let me hear what Krishna is saying in a, you know, in a calm, neutral, not blind acceptance, just to hear what Krishna has to say mood, rather than I already know and I don't care if Krishna doesn't, he doesn't say what I already know, that I don't like Krishna. It's Prabhupada helped me, because his explanations were not just giving like dogma, but he was giving reasons, you know, answering why questions. I think that's one of the things I could say that helped me become attracted and, you know, convinced, is not just this is, you know, it's this, not that, but here's why not that, and here's why this. You know, like children. If you say, you know, something, do this, they may ask you, or they may not ask you, but they're wondering why. Why do we do this? Why don't we do that? But if there's a why answer, it makes it much easier to say, okay, now I understand why. Fine. There's obedience, it's just submission, and then there's knowledge. And knowledge is stronger than just submission, because when the person who's saying, do this, don't do that, isn't around, what happens? Nobody's around. I could do whatever I want. So, he Prabhupada guided, as a disciple, guided me to understand why and then make wise decisions about what to do in making decisions and in how I'm going to do what I'm going to do. I think that's my background was science. I was in medical, you know, pre-med, and then enrolled in medical school. So that's I appreciated that approach. And Prabhupada knew his audience. His audience was with the Western world. That was the instruction from his spiritual master. And in the Western approach is question everything. And that was his audience. So he had to give the why answers. And he did give the why answers. Even before people would ask the questions. And that's one of the things that I felt from reading Bhagavad Gita. So many questions that I had got answered, and some of the questions I didn't even know how to articulate got articulated and got answered. You know, I felt, wow. I'm going to spend more time over here. Just because the lights went on from an inquisitive person. So, I guess the biggest was the sense of gratitude. Big, like really big. That someone at such an elderly age literally risked his life to come and rescue me, an insignificant nobody in some obscure place. Why? His kindness. And I received his kindness, and I can't just receive kindness and say, thanks, see you later. Can't do that. I felt gratitude and wished to reciprocate with feelings of gratitude. So he touched and changed my life. Just by his compassion and the pure message of devotion for, you know, spirit soul that's been wandering who knows how many lifetimes. I felt very grateful, deeply grateful, and wanted to do something about that. To receive what he wished to give in a way that he wished to give it, and give it to others. And just in whatever way I could try to assist him, in ways that he would guide and direct me. Here I am. 40-something years later, doing the same thing, trying. Okay. So should we have, what, a little kirtan because the prasadam is being offered?